The topic of the talk is going to be weak gravitational lensing of the astrometric kind, and I'm going to clarify what that means soon in a few slides. And we're going to be interested in gravitational lensing effects which are due to the presence of some dark matter substructures, in particular in the Milky Way. So let me start by giving you some motivation for looking for this effect by reminding you what we already know about dark matter. We know that dark matter must interact gravitationally. Indeed, all the experimental evidence that we have for dark matter comes from its gravitational effects, from cosmological observation to gravitational lensing, galaxy rotation curves. These are all examples where dark matter shows up through its gravitational interactions. And the experimental results, from the experimental results, we don't need to require any additional interaction, either of the dark matter with itself, so some kind of self-interaction, or between the dark matter and the standard model. And indeed, we also have very strong upper limits on the size of these additional interactions. To explain the experimental observations, for example, from the formation of structures in the universe, we only need to require that dark matter behaves as a cold and collisionless fluid. So if we take all this information into account and we look into the standard cosmological model, we don't have a satisfying candidate that can account for the total dark matter abundance. And in general, we need to introduce some new physics. We have large varieties of diverse models that can explain the dark matter abundance. And this model can have dark matter that span several decades in order of magnitude in mass and have different types of interactions. So given this variety of models, we would like to be able to rule out or pin down some of them. And for this reason, it's important that we learn as much as possible about the additional dark matter properties. So any kind of experiment or new ideas to test the dark matter properties is absolutely important. But for the purpose of today's talk, I'm going to focus on one particular type of dark matter searches, which are of the gravitational kind. It's probably not hard to convince you that gravitational probes are very interesting. First, because as we said, we know that dark matter does interact gravitationally, and we don't need to make any multi-dependent assumptions on additional interaction. So generically, we can apply these probes to a variety of models. In addition, being able to detect dark matter from its gravitational effects allow us also to learn about additional properties of the dark matter. For example, if we are able to detect through dark matter gravitational effects the distribution of dark matter within galaxies and how it clusters, we would be able to distinguish between models that predict different distribution for dark matter in galaxies. And we could distinguish between, for example, cold dark matter, in which case we expect a cuspid profile, or some model of self-interacting dark matter where we expect to have a core at the center. So here you see two pictures of very well-known examples where dark matter manifests itself gravitationally and that allow us to learn something about properties of the dark matter. On the left side is an image of the strongly lensed image from the Hubble galaxy cluster. And through images like this, we learn how the dark matter is distributed in the galaxy cluster. While on the right, you see another familiar example, the Bullet cluster, which is the result of the collision between two galaxies. And by measuring here where the dark matter is after the collision, we can put constraint on the self-interaction of the dark matter. So these examples are gravitational manifestations on very different scales, from galaxy clusters to galaxy scales. And today we're going to go to even smaller subgalactic scales. So we're going to be interested in gravitational lensing effects in our Milky Way. So here is the outline of the talk. First, I'm going to describe the physical effect of astrometric weak gravitational lensing and explain which type of lenses can generate them. In the second part of the talk, I'm going to present the experimental data set that we're using to detect them and explain why this is the right moment in time to do this type of searches, as we're living in the era of precision astrometry. And then finally, in the third part, I'm going to present our method, introduce the test statistic that we use, and present the results. And please feel free to interrupt me at any time with questions and comments. Good, so let's start from the physical effect. Gravitational lensing, as probably all of you know, is the effect of bending of light as it passes nearby a gravitational potential. So we have a source, a star, which you have to imagine to be located far away. And the light travels through an observer. So this will be us or a satellite that is looking at the stars in the sky. And we have a massive object in between them. We define the impact parameter, BIL, as the distance of closest approach between the light ray of the source and the center of the lens. And we denote with ML the mass of the lens. So here we're interested in gravitational lensing of the astrometric and weak kind. Astrometric meaning that we are looking at the effect of an angular shift in the position of the source and not in the effect of the source light magnification. And weak meaning that we will always be in the regime where the observer can only resolve one image from the source and not multiple images like in a strong lensing. So in this case, the effect that the observer see is that it's not going to see the star in its original position, but it's going to see it slightly shifted by an angular deflection, which parametrically is given by this formula. So the angular deflection is proportional to the mass of the lens enclosed within the impact parameter BIL, and it's inverse proportional to the impact parameter. Now, we can get a numerical estimate of the amount, the size of this angular shift by plugging in a lens mass of million solar masses, which can be a dark matter subhalo in the Milky Way, and an impact parameter of 1 parsec, which is roughly the distance from us to the closest star. For these parameters, we get that the angular deflection is of the order of 40 milliarc second.
So this is, I mean, what you get about is how much mass is within a parsec, right?
Right, yeah, this is a quite dense halo, yes. Yeah. It's not
How much density is
that
just at the end?
Sorry?
How much density is that just at the end?
It would be like at least a factor of 1,000 largest, more like a kiloparsec.
Oh, inside, yeah. So it's 10 to the 9 times more dense in order to see such?
Denser, yeah. I mean, here I just, if you have like a 1,000 times a larger impact parameter, you might still be able to see the effect. So this is quite a large angular deflection.
If it's just 14 microarcseconds, it's a million arcseconds.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. However, yeah, on an individual source, this effect is impossible to be seen since we don't have the information about the original position of the source. But you could think that you could be able to detect this effect by looking at a field of stars. And so if you imagine to do that and you go and look on the sky to a randomly distributed field of stars here, which are represented by these gray dots. If there is a lens between you and the stars, then what happens is that the position of each individual star is going to be shifted away from the lens. So, however, in practice, you don't have the information about the location of the lens, if this is a dark object, and you don't have the information about where these gray spots are, the original position of the sources. So we are really looking at something like this. And it's true that the lens induces some fluctuations in the density of the stars, but these are much smaller than the natural systematic density fluctuations in a randomly distributed field of stars. So we would need very high densities to detect these static effects. However, we can take a next step by going into the time domain. So by in the case we have a lens which is moving with respect to the observer during the time of observation of the background sources, the impact parameter with respect to each individual star is going to change with time. So the angular deflection is changing in time, and this induces an apparent motion on the background stars. So as the lens moves through the stars, these are moving around it. If we take a snapshot of this effect and we're able to measure the velocities of the stars in this field of view, we would see that they distribute themselves according to a specific pattern. And let me make it more obvious by looking at the field of uniformly distributed stars. So you clearly see that the velocity follow a dipole pattern. So this is a local observable that was proposed in the Halometry from Astrometry paper by Ken, Anna Maria, and Neil. And it's a specific pattern in the velocity of background sources that we can look for. Now we can do some numerical estimates here as well. So again, we have a lens that is moving during the time of observation. And if we assume that the relative change in impact parameter over the course of the mission is a small number, so during the time of observation is a small number, we can simply take instantaneous time derivatives of the angular shift. And what we get is the same parametric as before, multiplied by an additional factor of VIL over BIL, where VIL is the relative change, is the rate of change in impact parameter, or also the relative velocity between the observer and the lens. So again, if we plug in the same parameters for the lens and we take a typical velocity for the lens of a typical subhalo in the Milky Way of 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light, we get that the induced motion is of the order of 10 microseconds per year. So this is not too far, but it's still below current experimental precision.
So what is the current experimental precision?
So this depends a lot on the type of source, because it depends on the source, how bright it is the source and where it is on the sky. But for the sources that we're going to be interested in, measured in Gaia, it's of the order of 10 milliarc second. With current Gaia data.
But 10 milliarc second or just 1 milliarc?
10 milliarc second per year. Yeah. But okay, so this is for an individual source. However, we can take advantage of an important properties of modern astrometric survey, which is that they deliver large catalogs of stars. So we can use statistics and try to detect this effect in aggregate. And also we can keep in mind that time, things are going to improve with time, and these measurements are predicted to improve in the next few years. Okay, so if there are no questions on the physical effect, let me move on. Yes.
So how would
establish these proper motions from the intrinsic proper motions of the
stars. Right. So of course, yeah, the stars are in general will not be stationary. They're gonna have some intrinsic proper motion. And we take that into account by when we define our test statistic, we are gonna weight by the intrinsic proper motion dispersion of the stars. So we want to look for this effect on top of the.
Yes, you mean as a Lagrangian proper motion of the stars, or because there's of course coherent proper motion.
Yeah, the coherent proper motion in the gravitationally bound systems we can subtract because generically is on a scale which is much larger than the effect of the gravitational lensing. Okay, so the these gravitational lensing effects that we're looking for are due to the presence of these dark matter substructures. So let's see where these are coming from. The story goes all the way back to the early universe that we know was nearly homogeneous up to small fluctuations of a few in 10 to the 5. As you see in this map measured by Planck, we have some hotter and colder spots, which correspond to matter overdensities and underdensities. So as the universe cools, the overdensities will grow and collapse, forming the seeds to generate all the structure that we see in our universe today. So our universe today, unfortunately, you cannot see this picture very well. This is a picture of our galaxy as taken by Gaia. And so this region up here is mostly dark. So you see that there is high inhomogeneities, higher densities in the galactic disk, the galactic center. And we also have smaller structures, like the Magellanic clouds here in the South Hemisphere. But we also expect to have structures at scales smaller than Milky Way satellites. However, this structure would be too small to host to have had star formation, so we wouldn't be able to see them directly from luminous objects. So yeah, unfortunately, probably you cannot see this, but we expect that our galaxy is populated by a hierarchy of dark structures. And these objects can be responsible, even though we cannot see them directly, can be responsible for gravitational lensing effects if they sit in front of some background source.
Something?
Yes.
The stars that Gaia observed, where are they? Are they close to the disk or are they away from the disk?
Most of the stars that Gaia is seeing are Milky Way, in the Milky Way, yeah. But they are also observing satellites.
So do you expect that the line of sight then is within the disk?
If you were using Milky Way stars, yes. That's why we are gonna use dwarf galaxies.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay. So you don't expect, because some of the subhalos should be tidally disrupted.
Yeah, but we're gonna use basically all the integrate over the whole Milky Way halo because we're using stars which are 50 kiloparsec away.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, how big is the sample then? But if most of them are the billion stars that Gaia will use.
So in the LMC they see 10 to the 7. Yeah.
And what's the probability? Sorry.
Yeah.
But the LMC is very small.
It's like 10 degree, 8 degrees by 8 degrees on the sky.
So what's the probability that actually something goes in front of it?
So you cannot reach a bit very high masses, but if you have a 10 to the 8 solar mass clamp. You still, or smaller, you still have, yeah. So yeah, for dwarf galaxies, you are limited by the angular, the solid angle that you're looking at. One problem when you want to look for gravitational lensing effects, which are due to extended lenses like dark matter subhalos, is that the angular deflection is going to have a maximum for an impact parameter of the size of the same size of the characteristic size of the lens, where we define the characteristic size as the distance within which most of the mass is enclosed. Indeed, if we go to smaller impact parameters, we're not really boosting the signal because also the enclosed mass is decreasing. So in general, we have, for large subhalos, we have to pay this size suppression, but larger subhalos are also gonna have more background sources behind them. So again, we can leverage on statistics and try to compensate for this size suppression. Okay, good. So I'm gonna move on to the second part and the experimental data set. Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, some of these slides you cannot see very well.
The problem is the projector, I'm sorry, but the projector here.
But yeah, here is the Gaia satellite. Gaia is a space-based optical telescope which is currently taking data, and it's measuring velocity positions and velocities for billions of stars, mostly in the Milky Way and some stars outside of the Milky Way, with very good precision. What the satellite does, it's rotating around its axis. It has two cameras which are continuously scanning the sky and observing each individual star multiple times. So they have multiple observations of each star, which are represented here by these white bars. And then the Gaia collaboration takes these individual observations and they perform a fit with a 5-parameter curve, which include the two-dimensional position of the star, the two-dimensional velocity, and the parallax. So the parallax is the reason why this curve has this funny shape, because remember that as Gaia is looking at the star, is also rotating around the solar system. So it's looking there is an effective circular motion in the star, which is added to the linear motion, giving this helicoid shape curve. And this effect is going to be smaller for stars that are far away. So the parallax just gives us a measure of the distance of the star. Now, yeah, going back to your question, we have to select the stars which are the best target for looking for gravitational lensing. And these are the ones that have small intrinsic proper motion dispersion, since we want to detect small effects on top of the proper motion dispersion. And we also want to maximize the probability of a dark matter subhalo to cross the line of sight between the observer and the stars. So in general, we want to select stars which are far away, like dwarf galaxies, or even better candidates are the quasars, which have nearly zero intrinsic proper motion dispersion. But yeah, we also want, since we're leveraging on statistics, we also want to have high densities. So with the current Gaia dataset, we can use dwarf galaxies, while the quasar catalog in Gaia is still limited, but there are future experiments like SKA, which is gonna be a ground-based radio telescope that are planned to measure large catalogs of quasars over the whole sky. So we would even have we have larger solid angles, so we can go even to larger masses. So we select from Gaia data, we select the Magellanic clouds, which are these two luminous sources in the, yes?
Sorry, quick question. So this error of proper motion for the LMC or SMC stars, is that the same as 100 million microseconds per year, or is it a bit larger?
It's a bit larger, so for the fainter stars, I'm going to show a histogram of the proper motion dispersion in the Magellanic clouds. So we query the Gaia catalogs and we select all the stars which have a good astrometric solution in the location of the Large Magellanic Cloud and Small Magellanic Cloud. So here I'm always going to show plots in array, right ascension and declination, which are, for non-astrophysicists, are just equivalent of azimuthal and polar angle in spherical coordinates. And these are filled of like roughly 10 degrees by 10 degrees on the sky.
Is the number of individually, the number of stars you're recording, 10 million or about 1.5 million, so are those individually identified in Gaia?
Yes, they're really like individual stars with position and velocity information.
Because like the Gaia like point spread function is like half an arc second or something, I think, right?
Half an arc second.
So therefore, there should be like many stars inside of the, inside of the PSF.
Yeah, for these, you think these are it would be too denser than that?
Each star being found, presumably, is like some blend of many stars.
Yeah, okay. In that sense, yeah.
Each one is being lensed differently, presumably, right?
As long as it appears on the sky as a luminous source and it's not, they don't resolve. I think that we can treat it as one source. We don't really, because we're just looking at the
lensing effect is the same for all the stars in the PSF, but it's not, right? Because you are
the angular deflection, if the distance between the stars is much smaller with respect to the impact parameter, should be the same.
Putting impact parameters that were tiny compared to an arc second, right?
How big is the lens?
We're gonna look at lenses which are the impact, the minimum impact parameter depends on the density of the stars. So the smallest impact parameter we're gonna use is it's of the order of 10 to the minus 3 degrees.
3 arc seconds.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's enough to give you.
You don't have, for any lens position, the probability of having one source which is closer than 10 to the minus 3 degrees, it's zero.
For CDM, I guess, abundance, you mean?
No, no, just given this field of star, this density of stars, you can, you can compute for any position on the sky. What's the probability of having a star within 1 arc second? Yeah. Okay, so yeah, then we're performing some cleaning procedure on this set of stars. First, we remove objects which are overdense than their environment, which are probably not belonging to the clouds, here corresponding to these red circles, or they might be like gravitationally bound objects. However, we also, as we mentioned before, these are rotating gravitationally bound systems, so the stars in the cloud are rotating, have some non-zero average motion that we need to subtract. So here, this is just a density plot that, again, you cannot see of the average motion of the two component of the velocity of stars in the LMC. So there are some different stars, stars in different locations in the cloud are moving in different directions. And we subtract these large scale motions by using a filter on a scale of 0.1 degree, which is one or two order of magnitude larger than the lensing effects. So we don't expect to remove any signal from with this subtraction. And we also remove outlier velocities to remove contamination for foreground stars from that comes from foreground stars.
So what's the physical scale corresponding to this 0.1 degree?
It depends on the distance of the, yeah. But the distance of the lens,
it's like a 500th of another radian,
It's like 5 parsec.
And so then, so the assumption you're making here is that velocities are not correlated on scales below 100 parsecs.
Yes.
But there's plenty of gravitational structures on scales.
Yeah.
That, so therefore, the velocity power spectrum should extend down to smaller than this.
Yeah. If we look at the then we can, of course, we're gonna still have some velocity dispersion after the subtraction, and we're not gonna assume that this velocity dispersion is perfectly Gaussian, and so we're gonna take into account the noise sources, which
I just mean that there's correlations among
but still they're not gonna be exactly this. They're still gonna be different from the signal induced by a lens, which is a specific. As you sum over a lot of stars, I don't know. Yeah, I don't have a good answer right now. But yeah, okay. At least now we don't see any signal. So even if there are.
It would still be a monopole effect, right? The one you're talking about. If they look at the dipole pattern, isn't that specific of the same they're looking for?
I mean, so there's gravitational structures on a whole range of scales. And so I can imagine them generating monopoles, dipoles, butterfoles, everything. Right? Even the velocity correlations among the stars.
100 parsec. So how big is the Magellanic Cloud in size?
Yeah, it's like scale length, I guess. It's like, yeah, a kiloparsec, and scale height must be 100.
So the 100 parsec is that the arc second that you're talking about? So it's
bigger.
So it's bigger than the resolved source.
The size is like 10 times 10 degrees. Right? The thing that you are talking about, 21 degrees, so it's 100
or something. Sure, yeah. But my point is that there's like spiral arms and clouds of gas and just lots of density fluctuations that make gravitational fluctuations,
mm-hmm.
which therefore induce correlations in the velocities of the stars. Right.
And you think they could produce some like dipole that looks
there
like
be some non-zero overlap with
your
pattern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good point. I don't really have a good answer.
They can put upper limits, I guess.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. But yeah, if you were to see a signal, you could then, in a specific location, then you can perform some additional tests. You can look at analyzing maybe the full time series of the stars, or looking at their parallaxes. A gravitational lens signal would also induce some anomalous parallax. So in the case of a positive signal, there could be ways that you can distinguish from other correlated effect due to the crowd. So here is a histogram of the all the stars in the LMC and the SMC as a function of their magnitude, larger magnitude meaning fainter stars. The red histogram is proportional to the number of stars with that particular magnitude. And so you see that we are dominated by fainter stars. While the yellow curve here is the average quoted proper motion error, the proper motion error that is quoted by Gaia, while the blue curve is the average real proper motion dispersion of the stars in that particular G magnitude bin. And we don't want to underestimate the noise, so we're always gonna select the larger between these two errors. The red is occurrence on this y-axis. It's the scale for the
skirt. Nothing to do with that.
Okay. No, this is just how many stars are there. Okay, good. So let me move on to the third part, where we introduce the test statistic. The question that we're asking is, how do we test for the presence of a lens with a given mass and size, given the measured star velocities and their uncertainties? So how do we look this is for this dipole pattern? Assuming that we know the location of the lens. So the optimal test statistic, at least under the assumption that the measured errors are Gaussian, is given by the sum over all the stars behind the lens of the dot product between the measured star velocities dotted into our matched filter, which is this dipole profile that you see here for the two separate components, appropriately weighted by the inverse variance squared. So we also define a normalization factor n squared, which is the sum over all the stars of our matched filter squared. One comment that I forgot here is that we choose to ignore the details of the inner profile of the lens. So we cut the density profile at distances, at angular distances of the characteristic size of the lens, beta L. And I'm going to comment how these affect the signal-to-noise ratio in a few slides.
So I here means like a sum over
all the stars behind the lens. And effectively, then you can neglect stars which are three, four, or five times away from the size of the lens. Because this mu I goes, it's inversely proportional to the distance from the center of the lens. Mu I here is just
but the I index is
summing over stars, yes.
Okay. And so the assumption is that these sigmas are not correlated.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Now we can estimate the signal to noise ratio by looking at the behavior of the test statistic for signal. In the case of signal, we expect that the average measured velocity of the stars, the noise is going to average to zero, and we're going to get the expected induced proper motion due to the lens, which is given by this constant, which depends on the lens properties, times our matched filter. So the average tau for signal is proportional to, is given by this constant times our normalization factor n squared. While for noise, if we assume that we have properly subtracted the background motion, the average measured velocity is going to average out to zero, and the variance by assumption is given by sigma mu squared. So the variance for tau for noise is simply given by n squared. So we can compute the signal-to-noise ratio by taking the ratio between these two quantities. And we get that it's given by the constant CL times n. So it's proportional to this combination of the lens properties, where dl is the distance from the observer to the lens, the distance of the lens. Well, these are properties of the background sources. Sigma s is the angular density of stars, and sigma mu effective is the effective proper motion error, appropriately weighted average over all the stars. So the signal-to-noise ratio is maximized for lenses which are closer to us, smaller distances. And for a population of lenses with an abundance of mega L, if we are looking in a solid angle delta omega, the minimum distance at which we can have the minimum distance at which we expect to have one lens is proportional to 1/3 of ml over omega L times delta omega. So we plug in this minimum DIL and we get the behavior, the dependence of the signal to noise ratio with the lens properties. You see that the dependence on the abundance is not too strong. And also you see that we are limited by the field of view, the solid angle that in which we're looking. Good. So, okay, here is a side comment about our decision of truncating the lens profile. On the left, you have the expected induced motion due to the presence of a lens for a truncated density profile, which is a perfect dipole. While here on the right, you see the induced motion with a NFW density profile for the same size, beta L. And so you are way outside of beta L, the NFW profile looks similar to the truncated one. And because most of the signal is really coming from the stars which are immediately, which are very close to beta L, both in the inner part and the outer part, by throwing away the center, we're just losing about 50% of the signal, signal-to-noise ratio. And so we're losing a factor of 2, but we maintain generality, so that, and we don't specify the details of the inner profile of the lens. However, we could also do this analysis for a specific lens profile, like NFW.
What happens if you have a profile that's faster than 1 over r squared?
Yeah, in that case, you would probably lose more.
Yeah.
Because the signal for NFW only grows logarithmically inside beta L. But if you have something that grows faster, you might lose more. Okay, so what are we actually doing with the data? We have our test statistic, the stars from the LMC. What we do is that we zoom in into a specific location on this field of view. So this is the same plot zoomed in. We superimpose our matched filter and we get tau. And then we repeat these procedures scanning over all the field of view. So at the end, we end up with a series of values of tau for different lens locations. So we can look at the histogram of the normalized tau.
It's supposed to be a scanning, right?
Scanning. Yeah. Sorry. I'm sorry. It's a typo. Sorry. So here are two histograms for the template velocity, so the dipole directed in the horizontal or vertical direction. And for the normalized tau for noise, we expect it to have a nearly Gaussian distribution. And these are histograms for different lens sizes. Now, the real question that we want to ask, for now we define a local test statistic, which is the optimal test if we know the location of the lens. But we really want to test for a population of lenses in front of the LMC. So we want to get a global test statistic. And in this case, there are many random variables involved. So we have to make some simplifying assumptions, which are well motivated. First, that most of the signal comes from only one lens, which is the one closest to us. And still, we're going to keep the assumption that the measured errors are Gaussian. And given this hypothesis, we can write down the likelihood for the measured data if there is a population of lenses with a certain mass and size. This is going to be given by the product of the probability for having the closest lens in a specific location and with a given size, times the probability for the velocity distribution of the lens, multiplied by all the products of the probabilities for the observed velocity of the stars, which we take to be Gaussian. And the mean of this Gaussian is the expected signal, which depends on the lens properties times the match filter. So then we know that the best test statistic is going to be given by the maximum of the the likelihood ratio of our hypothesis divided by the likelihood of the same measurements without a lens, without the population of lenses. So what we do is that we maximize the log likelihood ratio. We maximize over the lens velocity, and we get this complicated expression. So I don't want you to capture all the details of this expression, but just one important thing that I want to flag out is that we are factoring in the information about the asymmetry in the velocity distribution of the lens. Since the observer is moving with respect to the lens, we're going to have a preferred lens velocity in the opposite direction of the velocity of the observer, this V naught. Then we maximize also over lens locations and sizes. So what we do from our histogram of the values of tau, we're going to take the maximum values for all the possible beta t's and for all the possible locations. So we're always going to be taking the maximums from the tails. And really, we're not taking the tails of this histogram, but of the histogram of the likelihood ratio, which is a similar histogram, but for the quantity that I define here, which depends on the lens properties. So we have different histograms for different lens masses, and it depends on this velocity asymmetry. So we're always going to take the maximum value of the log likelihood. However, as I said, we made some assumptions in deriving our test statistic. But the true measured errors are not Gaussian, and we also have general probability of having more than one lens. So we don't have the information about the true distribution of our likelihood ratio. So we cannot compute an analogous of a p-value for a measured chi-square. And in order to set some limit on a lens population, we need to use signal simulations. So what we do is that we fix some lens population parameters, some masses, size, and abundance. We generate a fake set of data, injecting the signal and also some data-driven noise. So we don't assume the noise to be Gaussian, but we fit it from the observed stars. And then we compute our optimal test statistic for both the data and the simulations. If in 90% of our simulations we get a maximum likelihood ratio which is greater than the one measured in the data, we are going to exclude this parameter space point and 90% confidence level.
And so in these mock data sets that you're making, when you have these in noise realizations that are data driven.
What that means?
What does that mean exactly? So you're.
It means that we are. So as we saw before, the true proper motion dispersion is a function of the magnitude of the stars. So we bin the stars in magnitude, and we fit for the PDF, the proper motion dispersion in that particular G magnitude bin, and then we extract random samples from this. Distribution.
One point is this, that it's not using any of like the spatial structure of the nuclides.
You mean the spatial dependence of the noise from the at different distances from the center of the cloud, or there is also
just the fact that the error here and the error here are correlated. For multiple reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're, these measurements are both made relative to the same reference
mm-hmm.
frame, right? And so errors in like the reference, like quasars, then produce correlated noise. But also there's just like physical correlations as well.
If we don't take into account these correlations, we are conservative, I would say. Conservative meaning that we put weaker limits than if we overestimate the noise.
I think you have to say you're radical, not conservative. The opposite of conservative. No, but I guess the problem is that if the noise is correlated, then it doesn't go down as the square root of n. So that's the main problem, that the noise is effectively bigger than what you think it is. If it's correlated from a star to a star. So the question is, what do you exactly mean by data-driven? That you include the correlation of the noise from a star to a star?
Yeah, but it seems not.
No, we're not including it, yeah. Okay, so, these are what we're doing in the simulation. Here are the stars from Gaia. We inject some signal that looks like our dipole profile, and then we go and compute tau for in this field of view. So here are density plot for tau for a dipole in the horizontal and vertical direction. You see for Gaia it looks like noise, and in the simulation, if we inject a signal with a lens moving in this direction, we're gonna see an excess. Larger value of tau in the location of the lens. So then we can look at the histograms of tau for the data compared to the simulation. So the yellow curve is the simulation with noise only, and the blue with the noise plus signal. So in this case, you see that we get excess in the tail, which are due to the presence of the lens. And the same thing if we look at the histogram in the likelihood ratio. We're going to get these large values of.
So if you look here, you're comparing the data and noise only.
Yeah.
It looks like there's a little bit of excess at, I don't know, 45 or so.
Here?
Yeah.
The red, here you mean?
Just below that, right? Yeah, that's right.
Our noise, here, yes, I understand. Our simulated noise, we don't want our simulated noise to be stronger than the observed data, otherwise it would be. So it's okay if the noise is underestimating the observed one. It's not the optimal thing, but we don't want the noise to be stronger than the one measured in the data, right?
But you want to correctly reflect the opposite, don't you?
If we are in.
To be conservative, you want your mock realizations to not underpopulate this tail, all right?
No, because if you are overpopulating the tail, then so imagine you don't inject any signal, and then your yellow curve has some values which are larger than the red curve, you're going to be excluding no lens. Right? If you don't inject any signal, but you measure a likelihood ratio which is larger in the simulated noise than in the data, then you're...
Maybe I'm missing. Okay, yeah. But
we... Okay, yeah. I can maybe explain it better.
Yeah, I'm just missing something.
Okay. Sorry. Okay, so then we, using this procedure, we can set some preliminary constraint on the plane, for example, of the abundance of the subhalos versus the masses. And here is the limit for a lens mass of 1 parsec. The blue curve is the 90% confidence level, and the green shaded region is for if 50% of the simulation produce a larger likelihood ratio.
What is the vertical?
Yeah, this is omega. So you see that omega in a unit of the observed Dirac vector abundance. So for now, we're not sensitive to subfractions of the dark matter abundance.
Where the y-axis is the density relative to CDM. So that you fix.
Here.
No.
You mean rho?
Rho.
No, yeah, I don't have, but.
Useful plot to have, because then you can fix dark matter and then you just put over dense stuff.
But here we're assuming that rho, you mean rho of the subhalo.
Yeah, not omega.
Yeah.
How much denser is the clump relative to the CDM prediction?
Yeah, I don't have that plot.
Does this assume when you're looking at a single ML?
A delta function for
it. Does that assume that all of the subcomponent is that mass? All of the subhalos have that mass.
Exactly.
It's not like a D by D ML. It's just
a delta function for that mass, In principle, we could factor in.
But it's also much denser than actual CDM, right?
Yes.
I think that's the main thing. So that they're really two different things.
No, that's why I'm saying you can fix the CDM. But the other thing is exactly what you asked.
I'm asking the same thing as you.
You
have some distribution.
Even in the CDM, right, you would expect, because it's log flat, it's scale invariant, you would expect that it's like how much 1% of the dark matter is in each decade of halos?
Well, those scales are. No, that's not true.
So if it's log flat, how much mass of the dark matter is in 10 to the 8 solar mass halo? Oh, because here the assumption is that it's a delta function, so all the dark matter is in 10 to the 8 solar mass
halos.
Yeah, that's the assumption.
But you should have just as many in 10 to the 8 as 10 to the 7.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying it's like in each decade you have some log, so it's like you defy, like it's 1% every decade, right? Depending on how many decades you have. So it's a few percent. Is that
I think the more serious thing. Modification would be the density, because I think that's like a secondary effect. If these are like 1,000 times denser than CDM, then I don't think it's really fair to compare it to CDM in any way.
Right. No, I'm not claiming that we are testing CDM.
The model that makes clear.
No, I know, but let me show you how we expect this to improve with time. So I agree that this is not currently a competitive limit. But so remember that the signal to noise ratio is proportional to 1/3 of the power of the abundance of these objects, and it depends on this combination of the properties of the stars. So we can estimate how this can improve with time, given that omega scales like the proper motion error cube, and the proper motion error scaling with is going to improve with time as time to the minus 3/2. So we expect that omegas will scale with time as with the power of minus 9 over 2. So in principle, since this is obtained using Gaia data after a bit less than 2 years, and Gaia is expected now to take data for 10 years, we could potentially have an improvement with in omega of a factor of 1,000. So this serves as a proof of concept that we can do this analysis, but I agree that for now the limit is not.
So if you assume, so this is from the large Magellanic clouds, this data that you're using.
Yes.
So now, if you assume that what Neil is saying is true, that there is a correlation of the level of, does Gaia measure the motion of stars in the halo? Is it sensitive to the, so if you assume that there was order one correlation, so how big is the velocity? I'm asking how big is the angular motion of the stars in the Magellanic cloud due to the fact that they are bound to the cloud?
The fact that they are, I think that the fact that they are within the cloud,
yeah,
should be at the larger scale than the effective, than the lens-induced effects. But, you know, besides what he was saying, I if I understood correctly, is that there are also correlated effects at the same scales.
Yeah, just because there's, like, you know, gravitational structures across a whole range of scales, even within the galaxy.
Yeah.
What I'm asking is how large can these correlations be? Because right now you're just statistics limited.
Yeah.
So how large can they be? Do you know? Is there a way to estimate those?
Oh, I mean, sure. So like, you know, molecular clouds.
Yeah.
You know, for example, their potential depth can be the kilometers per second, right?
Okay. And these would be that produces it that's comparable. Try to see if there's an estimate that you can do to see how far you can do. Maybe you don't get the factor of a thousand.
I think you actually have the data to do it. You just need to compute the correlation function of mu.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then you see how the scales with distance of basically that's the data you can look at. That's your noise, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
But,
that account for both physical correlations as well as like the noise correlations coming from the common reference frame.
Yeah. So yeah, what we've been saying so far applies to the LMC, for example, and the SMC. But for example, if you were to use quasars,
right. But they have a much lower number density.
For now, yes. Yeah.
Just physically, I mean, they have a really tiny space density.
Right, yes, but yes, so you couldn't test very small objects, but you would be looking at the whole skies, and you can test heavier lenses. I mean, as far as I know, like, SKA is supposed to measure like 10 to the 8 quasars over the whole sky.
Okay.
Which is to come
so
this.
In this LMC area.
In this LMC, there are like 10 to the 7 in 10 degrees squared.
With 10 to the 8 over 40,000 square degrees. Oh, stars.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, okay. So for quasars now, so it's 10 to the.
Is that 8 10 to the 8
square degrees?
Yeah.
So then 100 square degrees, and I divide that by, I guess, like 400.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that? Like a bit below 10 to the 6 something? Yeah, so it's quite a bit less than your stellar density, right?
It's the same.
Yeah.
Right.
But those won't be correlated, presumably, right? The same way that the stars are.
Yeah, except that you're using the quasars to define the reference frame, right?
But, yeah, we don't really care about relative velocities on large scales, but just at small scales.
Yeah, all I'm saying, you know, is that for Gaia, the quasar is always used to define the global reference. For
yeah,
and therefore then it's just tricky then to try to measure proper motions of quasars because they're defining the frame on the sky.
Yeah. Okay, I agree. Okay, yeah, so here is a plot of projections, optimistic projection for just simply assuming like a signal to noise ratio of one in the plane of the lens size over versus the mass. And yeah, here is the numbers with the numbers I was quoting with for SKA. And here is assuming an abundance of the objects equal to the dark matter abundance. So here is the scale mass relation expected with NFW. So yeah, we are far away from that.
Oh, so, like, okay, the precision though, like for SKA, you're saying is like orders of magnitude better than the astrometric precision for Gaia.
Right, yeah. So this is for the Gaia stars in the Magellanic Clouds.
Right.
Yeah.
Why is that so much better for SKA than microarchitects?
You can do radio VLBI, I suppose.
But like EHD is like 16 microarchitects, I suppose. I don't know how much you could go.
So 16 is absolute size. This is relative size. This is motion, right?
Even harder.
I don't know.
Yes. So you can like centroid much better than you can measure like your resolution, right?
I guess so.
At least for like bright sources where you have many, many photons, right? You know, so you can like, you know, centroid, you know, just something like the resolution divided by square root of number of photons. So is that how you're getting this
microarchitect? Yeah, I don't know really the details of this. I'm just quoting the numbers that are expected to be. Sorry. Too optimistic?
Yeah,
okay.
That's the case. Microarchitects, yeah, it's fantastic.
I guess it also depends on how much time you're.
Yeah, per year, you're saying.
Yeah.
On the parent plot, it seemed like you hadn't reached a sensitivity where you could see this, realize this dark matter microhalos. But here, I guess the point is if I got down to much smaller lens size, then I could realize it as dark matter already with given data.
These are not true limits.
Okay.
The previous one was a real constraint, while this is signal to noise ratio of one, which is more optimistic.
So yeah, I don't
understand that one size resolution. Yeah. Okay, so let me I'm almost done, but yeah, another interesting fact that we found out after we started our analysis is that there are already other data sets. For example, this one from the HST PROMO collaboration, which performs repeated exposures of the Hubble telescope in front of some galaxy clusters and also of the LMC, in particular, a small region of the LMC called the Cirri Doradus, which is the most richest star formation region that we see, I think. And this is a much smaller field of view of less than a degree, but with larger number densities. So potentially this set of data would be sensitive to smaller lens masses. And here, yeah, they don't measure the absolute motions of these stars, but they can measure relative velocities on small scales.
That means that if there are correlations, they could be appear here. Could they appear here if there are correlations? Was talking about?
Here they are not using a reference frame like the quasars, so they don't really know how the stars are moving with respect to us. They only measure relative velocities between stars that are nearby. So I don't know if the effect was coming from the calibration from the quasars.
You don't know, the effect is not coming from calibration of the quasars, it's coming from local actual correlations in velocity. This is what
both, I mean. Right?
Yeah, both.
Yeah, yeah, then the,
at least one of them they would be sensitive to. If there are local correlations of velocities that appear like a lensing effect, they could appear here.
Well, the correlated part drops out in the difference, right? But not completely.
Not completely, exactly. You could still see a dipole, right? I mean, there's still going to be something. Depending on the angular size.
So sorry?
Like the ones that go all the same direction, it's not the right shape to be.
Yeah, for structure on scales large compared to the separation. But again, their structure on all scales. Right, so for example, if I have two stars and some mass in between, it makes them flip. All right.
Okay, so since we're running a little bit over time, let me jump to the conclusions. So here, it, just to point out that there are other methods that people are using to look for dark matter substructures. But so today in this talk, we've seen how it can be possible to detect dark matter subhalos in the Milky Way using their gravitational lensing effects on the motion of distant stars. And this is possible today thanks to the incredible results of astrometric survey, which are combining high precision with large catalogs and large statistics. The important step of our work is that we were able to turn a proposal to detect dark matter into a real dark matter search and a real data analysis. The outcome of this analysis determine the behavior that we should, determine the approach that we should take. So in the event of no signal, we would still learn something about the dark matter. We would learn that if it cannot form halos, subhalos of a certain size and mass. But even more exciting would be seeing a positive signal. And in this case, we need to go beyond our current analysis strategy. But as I mentioned before, we have some clear ideas about possible further steps that we could do and further tests, taking full advantage of one important property of our test statistic, which is that we would have the information about the location of the lens today. So we can really have a closer look in this particular location, analyzing, for example, even with Gaia data alone, we can analyze the full time series, we can look at the parallaxes, we can test for other profiles like monopole or quadrupole, and see if it behaves like a lensing signal, or it can be due to other sources. And we could even have other telescopes to point in this direction and have and measure the velocities of stars more carefully. So I hope that this was enough to convince you that thanks to precision astrometry, it is possible today to try to detect dark matter substructures in the Milky Way. Thank you.
Other questions?
We already asked you questions.
Then, okay.
The people haven't asked questions, maybe they can.
Yeah, I think I have a comment for about your question about the energetic noise. The histogram that we were looking at was not the histogram of the proper the distribution of the stars' proper motion. In that case, if you plot the distribution of the injected noise in the velocity, you want to have larger tails. But when you look at the test the likelihood ratio, you want to have the maximum likelihood ratio in the simulated noise to be smaller than the maximum likelihood ratio measured in the data. Because the hypothesis, is the ratio of the hypothesis of having a population of lenses over no lens.
Right. And so your no lens is computed by making the
like large likelihood ratio means like large chi square, so small probability.
And so if you're underestimating the noise, then you're artificially making this ratio too big? No, isn't that what that means?
If you're underestimating the noise? Yeah, but we don't want to underestimate.
You are, the pure noise plot was less than the actual data. That's the thing that's alarming. If you forget about the actual injecting thing, it's just the pure noise.
Yeah,
that was below the real data.
But that was not the histogram of the proper motion dispersion.
It was a histogram of the signals you would detect. I mean, I guess your SNRs. I guess if you go to that part.
Mm-hmm.
Just the pure noise is the orange. And the real data is the red.
Yeah.
And it looks like there is more stuff in real data than pure noise, at what you call pure noise. So.
Yeah, but so these are all the values of tau at different locations. And then our optimal test statistic tell us to take the maximum values at all possible lens location, which means that we are taking the largest value of this histogram. We don't care about the whole histogram. We only take the maximum one, right? So.
It's like 5 sigma positions or something.
Yeah, exactly. So if the yellow curve gives you a value which is greater than the red curve, it means that you have a larger likelihood ratio in the injected noise with respect to the data. So you would be excluding noise only.
Yeah, so understanding is like what's being applied. We shouldn't hold everyone just for
Mike. Yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah.
Slope actually continues to actually understand what's going on with the high tail, right?
Yeah, if we don't really know that.
Fluctuations around something very small.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know how the tail behaves, and that's why we're doing the simulations. Like,
right.
If we knew that this was like perfectly Gaussian, then we would know what's the probability of having a 5 sigma fluctuation.
Right, so just looking at that,
Yeah.
I agree.
Okay, yeah, thank you.